This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
The week before last, on one single day, over 60 flood warnings were issued in England, 19 in Wales and 2 in Scotland. In videos, you could see flood barriers built only a decade earlier coming close to being overwhelmed. We seem to be seeing the future, and for us in the UK, it's looking wet. How wet? And how well prepared are we for what's coming? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start by finding out if we really are experiencing more floods than we used to. Here with me is Louise Slater, Professor of Hydroclimatology at the University of Oxford. Professor Slater, can you remind us of some of the big instances of flooding we've had recently?
In February 2020, we saw a succession of very large storms, the named storms Kira and Dennis, and they were bringing large amounts of water, of rainfall, to the UK in rapid succession over very saturated catchments, because we'd seen a lot of rainfall in the months leading up to that. And I think this is a typical example of the types of sequences of heavy rain events that we might see in the future, which can lead to heavy flooding. We had thousands of properties that were flooded in February 2020. If we look at the floods that occurred at the very beginning of this year, at the start of January, we saw the River Trent in the West Midlands, which reached its record high of 3.9 metres. And I think that's quite an interesting example, because we looked at how the data were changing on the River Trent, and what used to be a 50-year flood, what used to occur every 50 years on average back in the late 1950s, a level of 3.5 metres. Today, that level occurs every 9 years on average. So we're seeing much more frequent large floods than before.
Louise, what actually constitutes flooding?
There's a simple answer, which is that flooding is when we have excess water in the wrong place at the wrong time. But technically, we have four types of floods, which are river flooding, which is when you have too much water coming from upstream. So a river will breach its banks and inundate the floodplain. We have coastal flooding, which is when the seawater inundates the coastal area. We have rain, which is when you have very heavy rainfall. This leads to surface water flooding, often in cities, for example, with paved areas. So basically, it can overwhelm the drainage systems. And we have groundwater flooding, which is the one that most people often forget, but it's quite important. It's when the water table rises above the ground and it can enter into our basements and flood our basements. And sometimes we have the four of them occurring together, which causes compound floods. And those are the most important, sometimes the most damaging floods that we can see.
Right. Now, let's look at how those risks may have increased and start with rainfall. Do we actually have more rainfall in the UK than we used to have?
Yes, we are starting to see more rain than before. If you look at the last decade, for example, we have had wetter winters than in the past. We've seen some of the heaviest months of rainfall. For example, we had several years in 2014, 2016, 2020 with very wet months. And we've seen also a slight increase in very heavy rainfall also in recent decades. It's partly due to climate variability. We're seeing what's known as the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is our largest mode of climate variability, which brings strong rain, strong storms over the British Isles during the winter period. And this is what we've been seeing. We've been seeing these milder, wetter winters with stronger westerlies, storms coming from the west, hitting the British Isles and bringing more rain and greater floods. We know that as we're seeing a warmer climate, the air tends to hold more moisture. You can think of the atmosphere as a big bucket of water. And for every 1 degree of warming, it holds roughly about 7% more moisture. So that means that when we do see a rainfall event, a heavy rainfall event, it's going to bring more water down with it.
That means we've also, and the statistics show this, have had more flooding.
Yes, we have had more flooding. We have this amazing resource of high-quality river flow records for the UK in the National River Flow Archive, which is a dense network of river gauging stations telling us how water is changing over time in our rivers. And if we look at those records since the 1960s, sometimes far further back, we can see that floods have been getting bigger in many places across the United Kingdom. On average, we're seeing more flooding, larger floods, and occurring more frequently than they did before. Obviously, there are some exceptions. There are parts of the UK where we've seen decreases in flooding, such as eastern England. But overall, generally, since the 1960s, we're seeing more floods and larger floods.
What can we say about the impact of climate change and global warming on flooding?
It's a tricky question. There are different parts to it. On average, we do expect to see more intense heavy rainfall as the climate warms. And this is something that's well established that we understand and that we will see more intense heavy downpours. On the other hand, how river floods are changing around the world is a far more complex picture because we're not seeing increases in flooding everywhere. We're seeing some parts of the world, like the British Isles, where we have increases in river flooding on average, and other parts of the world, such as Eastern Europe or parts of the Mediterranean basin, where river floods are actually decreasing in magnitude. So it's quite a complex picture when you talk about river floods.
What can we say about predictions for the future, given we've got roughly 1.3 degrees of warming in the industrial era? Quite a lot of scientists anticipate that we won't be able to hold it at 1.5 degrees and we will actually go up to 2 degrees. Is it possible to create reliable models about what that will do to rainfall and flooding in the UK?
Yes, there are good models for understanding how that will change flooding in the UK. And we do predict larger, more frequent floods, different types of floods, whether that's coastal, pluvial. But there is obviously uncertainty also in our projections, coming from uncertainty from the climate models, from the hydrological models used, from different sources. So it's difficult to say precisely by how much floods will increase, but the broad picture for the UK is increases in the magnitude of flooding.
Right, let's talk now about the monitoring system. So how much notice will we get of where those floods will happen and of what magnitude they're likely to be?
That depends on the type of flood that we're talking about. So, for example, for a river flooding, we're able to predict relatively well in advance where we're going to see river flooding, especially in the large river basins, where the water levels rise quite slowly, the larger the river basin is. So big catchments like the Severn or the Trent, we can see that coming. But if we're talking about surface water flooding in cities, it can be much harder to predict where an intense heavy rain downpour is going to occur because it's much harder to predict what's happening in the atmosphere over short time frames.
Louise Slater. So we've heard that the consensus among scientists is that we are experiencing more rain and more flooding and that we can expect it to get worse. So if your home is at risk of flooding, what happens? Can you get insurance? Here to explain more is Professor Edmund Penning-Rousell, Research Associate at Oxford University Centre for the Environment. Edmund Penning-Rousell, what happens if your house is at risk of flooding? Can you get insurance?
Yes, you can get insurance. There is a scheme which helps people in high-risk areas to obtain what is called affordable insurance. But not everybody does, and that's what worries me.
Can you just explain that scheme a little bit and how it came about and what it consists of?
Okay, it's called Flood Re, and it's essentially a reinsurance scheme. That is to say, sits behind the insurance companies. And it was launched in 2016. as a result of serious flooding in 2007 and 2014, which really alerted government to the fact that some people are not insured because they can't afford insurance and premiums were going up. So it's an arrangement whereby the insurance companies pay into a pool, as they call it, and then they can use that pool money to subsidise the premiums charged by the insurance companies.
Right. OK, so effectively, the insurance companies pay for this. I imagine that in the end, the rest of us pay by very slightly increased premiums.
That's right. I mean, the whole nature of insurance, and particularly flood insurance, is that those at very low risk or no risk continue to pay for flood insurance in order to subsidise people who claim as a result of having the unfortunate circumstances of a flood affecting their property.
Right. Now, if I make a claim, do I know that I'm in this scheme?
No, you don't. I mean, you might be able to find out, but basically this is something that hides behind. I don't mean that in a conspiratorial sense. It hides behind the insurance companies and gives them a lump of money to subsidise those who are at high risk.
So you wouldn't actually know that you're being involved in it. The insurance companies know, but you don't. Now, who's eligible and who isn't?
Well, those whose houses were built after 2009 are not eligible, because it's argued by the insurance company that if people are developing in floodplain areas, they shouldn't have subsidised flood insurance. So they're not eligible to claim. Businesses are not eligible to claim. Other than that, there are some other small exceptions, but I won't go into those now. They're detailed.
OK, so if your home was built after 2009, then you're not eligible to claim and you're not effectively covered by this. Do we have any idea roughly how big a problem that is, just that section of it?
No, I don't. The number of residential properties built in flood risk areas since the beginning of this century is really quite small. I know there's a lot of huffing and puffing about it, but it's really quite small. So I don't think this is a major problem.
So essentially, people have got the message on that one and have had it for some time. We're still talking largely about the homes that were built before 2009, and those are the ones that are covered by the scheme. Is this a permanent scheme? Is this carry on in perpetuity?
No, it's due to end in 2039.
2039?
Yeah, and when the government and the insurance industry have committed themselves to an insurance regime which is risk-related, that is to say, the higher the risk you face, the higher your premium is going to be. So that's what they hope will happen, and they hope that people in the meantime will take some action to minimise the potential damage to their property.
Well, let me make sure absolutely certain I've got this straight. At the moment, your home's built before 2009 and it is at risk, then in that case you can get the insurance from the scheme, even if you don't necessarily know that that's what's happened. But in 2039, the same house, which has been covered by this scheme up until that point, may not then be covered.
Absolutely. That's what the promise is.
Okay. Do you think, I mean, given your knowledge of this area, that actually come 2038, somebody will say, well, we better keep on with this scheme?
I have a strong suspicion that will be the case. It'll be a brave government to say, you're on your own now, and your premiums are going to be related to your risk, and good luck.
Right. So this is very likely to continue. Now let's talk about the people who don't do it. It seems very strange that anybody would not insure themselves if they were in a high-risk area, and yet you're worried that many don't. Can you tell us about what you think about the scale of this problem and why you think it happens?
Well, I've done some research in Scotland where the problem is most acute. And, for example, 54% of the poorest people, the poorest 10% of the people in Scotland, have no insurance on their property at all. So there is a large slug of people in Scotland and also in Britain, who simply cannot afford to insure their property.
And finally, what do you think we could do about that?
Well, I think the flood reinsurance scheme, which is subsidising those at risk, should be extended to those who are not currently insured. Now, the insurance companies hate this idea, but I think we've been round the houses many, many times on this, and I don't think there's any other solution except to extend insurance to those who are currently not insured. It happens in France, where everybody is insured. If they pay for fire insurance, if they pay for any kind of insurance, there's a compulsory levy. It could be done in this country.
Emma Penning-Rousell, and just before we move on, if you want to hear more about how climate change is affecting the insurance industry, you can listen to Uninsurable Planet on BBC Sounds. Also, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes Is There Any Money?, where we take a look at how Conservative and Labour preparations for the next election will be dictated by the state of the UK's public finances. Now, back to flooding. We've talked about how the insurance system works for those at risk from flooding, but the problem is about far more than swamped houses. And if there's going to be more of it, what do we need to be doing that maybe we aren't? Here to explore this with me are Hannah Cloak, Professor of Hydrology at the University of Reading, and Stephen Forrest, Lecturer in Flood Resilience and Sustainable Transformations at Hull University. Hannah, can we get a sense of who's actually responsible? Who is responsible for planning our flood defences and for having a strategy to make sure that we are flood resilient?
So the government is responsible for funding our flood defences through the Department for Environment and onto the Environment Agency, who are then responsible for planning and implementing the flood defences. This is the same for Scotland and Wales. So the government, again, is responsible for funding the flood defences there.
Could you just describe for us what the government actually so far has been doing in terms of managing flooding?
So we have had this £5.2 billion promised for flood defences. I think that was back in 2020. And that's going through the system. It's really suffered from problems with inflation and other issues in terms of procurement, which means we're actually getting less value out of that money and less schemes will be funded now through that money. And it sounds like a loads of money, actually, doesn't it? £5.2 billion. But it will only fund a few of the very many schemes that are on the list waiting to go in the wings.
And that picture is broadly the same outside England, is it?
There's a lot of investment in flood defence. I think all of the governments know that it's really important and it needs doing. Is it enough? Probably not. I mean, you could throw all the money that you could at flood defences, everything in the government's pot, and we would still not be able to keep everybody safe from flooding.
Stephen Forrest, over the last few decades, what have we actually done in this country to manage flooding? I'm thinking, obviously, that we've had at least a decade of austerity. So have our flood management plans survived that period?
So traditionally, we've been separating or trying to keep the water away, fighting against the water. And you might think in your mind to the Thames barrier, or in Hull, we have a tidal surge barrier. And these are essentially ways to separate water or to try and keep the water back from where we live, to our cities, our urban spaces. However, we see some challenges with that. Sometimes they may fail. There might be some uncertainty around whether they're going to be ready for future changes in extreme weather events. So we've tried to shift from that. And we're seeing this idea, you know, not just trying to put a big divider between us and water, but instead making space for water within our cities, trying to slow the water as it enters our cities as well.
There are many different ways that we can defend ourselves from flood. Those traditional kind of walls along the side of rivers, those levees that really try and keep the river channel in its channel, don't let it escape, chain it in effectively. But they're not really very effective in many ways, and they can speed up the flow of water and they can make everything worse. But we've got a lot of them in this country left historically.
Just before you carry on, I think that takes a little bit of explanation, because there I am, I'm standing there and looking at this wall which is holding the water bank and thinking, oh, that's jolly good, really. Yet you're saying that they can create more problems?
Yeah, they can. And one of the biggest ones is that they can fail. And we have many old defences in this country, some of which failed in the recent floods. And if you do imagine standing there on the wall and the river is full and it's racing past really, really fast and it's dirty and brown, that's a terrifying amount of power in that water. And that's why they often fail. And also they can be overtopped. So we saw some new defences put in Carlisle a few years back that were nearly immediately overtopped because they weren't built high enough. We can't keep building higher and higher and higher walls along our rivers because nobody wants to live in a place with huge walls along the river. And also, that's not the right thing to do. We need to do other things. It's no good shooting the water downstream to where people will flood downstream and passing that problem on. It's much better to store that water in the landscape and make space for it.
Those other ways of storing water, Stephen Forrest, what are they?
Well, we can store water in different ways. We can store them in our cities, but also in our countryside. While it's moving through the countryside, we can have retention areas or these spaces where we can store water. In Hull, we have some aqua greens as well in urban spaces, but we can also try and slow the water moving through.
What is an aqua green?
So an aqua green is something that we have in Hull, and it's essentially these spaces, these nice green spaces where they're in the daytime, normal times, they're empty. They just look, you know, like a grassy area. But then when there's a lot of water expected, we can activate these and we can then store some of this rainwater in these aquagreens. So instead of it ending up in our sewage system and maybe leading to flooding in other areas, it's stored in a place that it can then be released after the biggest bit of the rainfall is gone.
Right. So we have engineering responses which we think are inadequate quite often, but which need to be supplemented by water storage. What else do we need to do?
Well, in addition to that, is slowing the water's movements. We want to try and absorb it as much as possible, because one of the problems is all the water coming together at the same point. And in that point, it's all kind of overwhelming our systems, and we're not ready for that. So we end up with water not being taken away from our systems, taken away from our cities, but then rising and inundating some areas. So we'd like to try and store it, and this might be through green roofs, it might be through rainwater barrels, it might be just in greener gardens instead of having it paved over, which stops the water from moving through the landscape. It's instead having nice green spaces. So these are spatial solutions that can really slow the movement of water and make a difference for a flood event.
And I think a lot of people would be surprised to think that there are kind of myriad things that people in localities or individual people can do to make this better at scale enough to be more effective than, say, engineering solutions.
Yeah, we've always thought of these big structures as being the solution. They look like they're very strong and we should be implementing them. But if everybody did something and everybody trapped the water off their own roofs, they changed the paving in front of their gardens, they perhaps used the water differently. Really, I think that we can make a massive difference because there's a lot of us that live in this country, but we don't tend to do that. We don't reuse and recycle our water. We don't collect it from our roofs. More often than not, we contribute to the problem by paving over things and just assuming someone else is going to take that water away for us.
So we need a national Trap Your Water campaign.
Oh, absolutely. That would be great, wouldn't it? And it would make a big difference very quickly.
Stephen, what else can we do as individuals to increase, what would you call it, our resilience in the event of flooding?
On an individual level, it can be maybe an initial start is to check, are you at flood risk? And you can do this online by checking the government website or just looking at check your own flood risk. If you know what type of flood risk you're at risk from or you might be facing, you can then start to make plans about how you might deal with this. A simple one is to sign up for flood risk warnings. So then if there is a flood risk alert or warning in your area, you'll receive an update on your phone. What you can also do is think about having a flood plan. Think about what would happen if there was a flood event. What would I do? You might want to move your personal belongings upstairs, for example. For example, a lot of people have nice photos, passports, legal documents stored downstairs, and it might be quite close to the floor. If the flood water comes in, that would be quite devastating for a lot of people. So we need to think about moving things or having a plan for if the worst case scenario happens.
Stephen, are there any parts of the country where, frankly, it has just become too expensive or even pointless to try and stop flooding? It's going to flood. Go somewhere else.
I think this is the idea of resilience. It's not trying to prevent every flood event, because we're not going to be able to stop all the floods. It's instead shifting towards reducing the flood consequences. So some areas will have water, they will have floods, but if we can make properties more flood resilient and we can take measures, we can work at neighbourhood levels and also maintain the assets that we have, then we can make it so that we reduce the consequences of those flood events.
I suppose to argue against the point I've just made, Hannah, there are other countries, of course, like the Netherlands, whose entire existence is based on stopping flooding. Are there lessons that we can learn from countries like that?
The Netherlands is a really good example of where they've chosen to move people out of those areas that are really at risk, those very low areas, or those areas that they wanted to use for storage areas. And, you know, that's really quite controversial, saying to people, I'm sorry, you have to move out of this area because we need that to store the floodwater in and we don't think it's safe for you anymore. But there are perhaps areas in our country where we might want to think that through a little bit more carefully. We saw some terrible floods in 2013, 2014 on the Somerset Levels, for example. And that's a very difficult conversation to start. But certainly we can learn from the Netherlands from that.
The other thing that I thought was interesting was we talk about the Netherlands, but then I seem to recall that in Germany, floods fairly recently were absolutely catastrophic. In other words, the kind of model that they know how to do it on the continent didn't quite work. What lessons should we learn from that?
That was July 2021. Across Europe, so it wasn't just Germany, and even, in fact, in the Netherlands, there were some very serious floods. A lot of rain fell, this is true, but the main drivers of those people, those hundreds of people who died, were people weren't expecting the flood. They didn't get the warnings that they need. It happened too quickly. The land management was really poor, which contributed to the flood. And so all of those things, if you translate those here to the UK, there are many areas we need to improve on. We know in the recent floods, some people didn't get the warnings in time. There was floodwater in their house before they received those warnings. So there's some things to do with our flood forecasting and warning systems we need to improve. But really getting people to understand they're at risk. And then when they do have the information from a forecast, know what to do, that they need to evacuate, to believe that it could happen to them.
Do you both think that we have the planning already in place in this country to meet the changes that we are going to face in terms of climate, rainfall, and therefore flooding? Hannah?
We do not have the plans in place to deal with what's happening now, let alone what's going to happen in the future, to do with flooding, to do with drought and water security, to do with heat waves. We need a joined up approach to deal with all of these hazards that are coming towards us. You know, our train lines are not ready, our infrastructure, our water companies are not ready, our homes are not ready, and we don't seem to have the imagination to deal with that problem at a governmental level.
Steve.
I think a major gap that we've got now is how we recover from a flood. And instead of going back to how we used to be and how it was before the flood event happened, we need to try and think about bouncing forwards. And for that, we need to think about the future and think about the future conditions we might face.
Okay, so there are two points there. The first one to you, Stephen, is what does that actually mean in practice?
In terms of
what you would actually do, what policies you would effect in order to meet that challenge.
So everyone who's been flooded in the recent flood events should get the support, should get the funding and also the expertise in order to try and build their home back in a way that if a future flood happens, they won't be as badly affected. This can be measures such as raising the electrical sockets in their home. It could be things such as putting property flood defences in their home to stop the water entering. It could be also thinking about the urban space and our green spaces in order to try and stop the next flood. So we're already thinking ahead, not waiting for the next flood to happen, but we're thinking, what if and what can we do?
Stephen Forrest there with Hannah Cloke. My thanks to them and to Louise Slater and Edmund Penning Rousell. And my conclusion is, our future looks pretty wet and we're going to have to learn to live with it rather than always just to fight it. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nick Holland, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was Hal Haynes and the editor is Richard Barden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Cobalt. A thriller from BBC Radio 4.
Hey, Dad.
The person you're trying to reach is not available.
£603 to Rwanda Air. That's the price of a one-way ticket.
to Zimbabwe.
Good afternoon, ma'am. We're looking for Mr. Manfred Zibanda.
Is there a problem?
Not yet.
They've been in a few times this week looking for the cobalt that went missing.
Would you risk it for 20 million?
What the hell is Dad doing in Zimbabwe right now?
Cobalt on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.